We're joined live here in the studios once again by Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Plenty happening this week as we,
Although anybody who went to Cal Anderson Park this morning thinking there was going to be a women's march was sadly disappointed. It got postponed to March 8th, I believe.
Yeah. Any insight into why?
I think they were concerned about the weather early in the week.
Okay.
The national one is still going on this morning in D.C.
Yeah, you can go online and see video cities. Of it.
Yeah, but not here. We're waiting for International Women's Day, which is a holiday.
Yeah, those of us who
celebrated all over the world, kind of.
Those of us activists who have camped out in the snow, who have marched through downpours, we feel like that was kind of a wimpy thing to do, but
it was.
You don't know.
I remember WTO. Uh-huh. It rained all that week.
Oh, yeah. 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 Oh, yes, I remember.
All right. Let's dive in, starting with City Council passing the Clean Campaigns Act, or at least parts of it.
The original, Maria talked about this last week, the original legislation has three pieces. Two pieces of the passed committee last week and passed the City Council unanimously this week. Those two were limits on corporate donations to campaigns if those corporations have more than 5% foreign ownership, which probably includes most publicly traded companies at this point. Certainly it includes Amazon and Microsoft, all those guys. But that passed unanimously, and some transparency measures in terms of reporting online advertising, which were an issue last year. Mm-hmm. The part that is most controversial has been deferred until spring. That was the part that puts limits on corporate PACs and how much they can spend. And that is very likely to face a court challenge, no matter how they word it.
Yeah, but, so that was limits on donations to PACs by corporations.
Yeah, and it's the same issue of foreign ownership mm-hmm. that they're trying to address. But, they deferred that until spring. And both Teresa Mosqueda and Lorena Gonzalez are on maternity leave right now, which is kind of awesome. But when they get back, I'm sure they'll be dive right in.
Yeah, I think Lorena Gonzalez gave Lisa Herbold the go-ahead to kind of shepherd that third bill through, and she'll be trying to get it in shape for March when Gonzalez is back from maternity leave, and they will move it along, hopefully pass it.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Mayor Durkin, withholding funds, we talked about this last week, and it sounds like she's withholding.
She was withholding funds on LEAD is what the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program. I talked about that last week. It turns out that she's put a hold on other funds for other programs, too. And I just want to mention what some of those are. Erica Barnett reported this on her blog, The C is for Crank, this week, that Durkin is also holding back funding for at least three other programs that Durkin had not put money in the budget for or increases in the budget for, and that the City Council had allocated funds for. The first one of those is the Homes for Good.
How very Trumpian.
Yeah, the Homes for Good pilot program that would use about $700,000 to provide small rent subsidies for people over the age of 50 who are receiving federal disability payments of under $1,000 per month. Often when you receive disability payments, it will bring your annual income above a certain threshold and you no longer receive rent subsidies.
Yes, and a number of other social service programs as well.
Yeah, and a lot of those folks who find themselves finally qualifying, because it can take years, qualifying for federal disability payments, find themselves unable to make rent and they end up homeless. So this program was meant to address that issue and that problem, to try to close that pipeline of people being pushed into homelessness when they get on federal disability.
And $700,000 is a drop in the bucket for the city budget.
In the city budget, yeah. So that was one program that the City Council funded and that Durkin has put on hold. She claims that it was a one-time funding for a pilot program, and she doesn't know where the funds are going to come for, where the funds are going to come from in the future to keep that program going. But that hasn't stopped the mayor from funding other pilot programs, particularly law enforcement type pilot programs, which
she seems which is where the money could come from.
Yeah, which she seems to continually be able to find funding for. Take, for example, the summertime special. What were they called again? The special patrols that were done in seven neighborhoods.
The emphasis patrols.
Yeah, that was a pilot program. She found one-time funding for that. And then later when she wrote her budget for this next year, she found money to continue that and was trying to expand it. So Durkin doesn't have any problem with other pilot programs, just the ones that the city council wants.
Just the ones that she doesn't like.
Yeah, now the second program is a $1 million program to pay for rapid rehousing, direct services, and outreach to homeless Native Americans and Native Alaskans through the Chief Seattle Club and other nonprofits. That was one that Deborah Juarez in particular sponsored and wanted to push through, and the city council agreed that was a good spend of $1 million, but Durkin has put that on hold with no explanation at all as to why. The third program is $1.8 million the city council allocated for new tiny house villages that prioritize referrals from LEED, the navigation team, and the Seattle Municipal Court. And that was a program that was primarily pushed by Mosqueda and Sawant. And that's an issue that goes right to the heart of Mayor Durkin's priorities when it comes to homelessness response. She's all for the police response, sweeping homeless.
I think she would fund those tiny villages if they were located in Skagit County.
She's not convinced that the tiny house villages are a good use of city funding. And she did not allocate any additional money for tiny house villages in her budget. It was all the city council that put more money in the budget for those. Sawant had wanted much more money and had wanted to divert that money from things like the emphasis patrols and police raises and hiring bonuses. And that didn't go through at the council level. But Lisa Herbel had helped to find other money in the police budget, particularly money that had not been spent for new hires to go into this program for a new tiny house village. So that could be why Durkin has put it on hold. She didn't like the fact that that money was transferred in the city budget, so now she just doesn't want to spend it.
And I think she's really trying to draw a line with this new, more progressive city council and say, I don't care what you do. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to enforce it. I'm not going to fund it.
Yeah, no, she's really drawing a line in the sand. She's saying, look, if I don't like what this new progressive city council passes, I can just exercise executive authority to just not do it, which really I think is an abuse of power. And it'll be interesting to see if the city council has a response to this and what that response will be.
Absolutely. And, you know, I said this, I think, last week, and I'll say it again. Now is the time to be organizing a credible challenge to Durkin in 2021.
Yeah.
Because she really needs it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how those moves by her resonate with her Chamber of Commerce supporters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
Okay. Also this week, Seattle Times had an interesting article about the navigation.
they got right on it last summer.
Seattle Times. Yeah, finally, the Seattle Times had a reporter, Sydney Brownstone, look into what actually happens when the navigation team sweeps encampments. The title of the article is When Seattle Stores Belongings Taken During Homeless Cleanups, Few Get Them Back. Duh.
There's
That's something,
a shock.
Something we've been talking about. And
for
has
years
been,
and years
has been
and years.
Going on for a couple decades at least. Now, Brownstone pointed out that in the 10 months between January 1st and October 31st of last year, the city swept, quote, 745 encampments, most of them with little notice, compared to 468 removed during all of 2018, end quote. So the city is on track, if we eventually get the November and December numbers, to have almost doubled their encampment sweeps. Now, after interviewing outreach workers, Brownstone writes that homeless people in Seattle are increasingly losing their medications, medical devices, wallets and IDs, important documents and personal photographs, and even credit cards in these sweeps. Part of the trouble, of course, is that the city has no centralized storage location where homeless people can go to claim and pick up their property. Instead, during a sweep, they're given a phone number to call. But when they call that phone number...
That doesn't really work if they've taken their phones.
Yeah, true. Often people have phones on them or they don't have a phone at all. That's one of the big issues is a lot of homeless people don't have a consistent access to a phone. Now, when a homeless person tries to get their belongings back, if they call, often the call isn't answered and it goes to voicemail. Sometimes the voicemail is full. And if a homeless person has to leave a message, they often don't have an accessible or reliable phone where they can receive a call back. The Times report said that after encampment sweeps, the city stored homeless people's belongings, this is in 2019, in 343 instances, but returned them in only 30 instances last year.
That's less than 10%.
Oh, yeah. Less than 10% of the belongings they kept. Often the navigation team and the city throws away personal belongings. Now, among the medications collected were antibiotics, pain medications, and EpiPens. It can be extremely difficult and costly to replace medications or to get them refilled when they're lost.
And EpiPens are notoriously expensive
now. Yeah. Now, for example, there are monthly limits to the number of pain pills a pharmacy will dispense to a person or an insurance company will allow if you have insurance. And that also includes Medicaid and Medicare. Now, and doctors often won't phone in a renewal without seeing a patient first. So sometimes they have to get in to see their doctor before they can get
there. And how do you do that? And how do you go claim your belongings if you don't have your ID?
Exactly. Without pain medications or medications to treat drug addictions, people often on the street often default to street drugs like heroin.
Right.
And heroin is cheaper than fentanyl or trying to find your pain medication from a dealer. Now, when a homeless person loses their belongings, service providers are also complaining now that they find themselves spending money on replacing those very important items like personal IDs, driver's licenses, ID cards, instead of spending it on securing housing. And that's a huge waste of money and resources that should be devoted towards getting these people off the street.
On the other hand, the city has all these belongings. They can put them up on eBay and raise some money for some of Durkin's programs.
I was thinking about that with the EpiPens. We should probably be looking for those on eBay.
Right. I don't think so. No, I think they should be returned to the people that they were taken
yes,
from.
Well, obvious. That's obviously.
And definitely not thrown out.
Obviously, mm-hmm. The first priority for the city is making it more and more difficult for people to get out of homelessness. And we're seeing that across the board with city programs.
This is just a huge side effect of the sweeps. And it was interesting that the Seattle Times finally ran an article on this through their, they have their, you can see it on their website.
Their
Project Homeless, and where they occasionally post these longer form journalism articles on various aspects of homelessness. Usually it involves complaints from, you know, businesses and neighborhoods and focusing on different service providers occasionally. But this was an interesting article. And it did take them a while to get around to actually interviewing outreach people and talking to homeless people about losing their belongings.
I know Sydney. She was a very good reporter mm-hmm. at The Stranger and still trying to be at The Times. I wonder how long she was pushing them to try and do this article.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to find out how long she pitched this article before the Times editorial board or her editor allowed her to actually proceed.
It would be her editor, yeah.
Yeah, proceed with it.
But the editors know what the corporate priorities are.
They do.
All right. Moving on, big Sound Transit meeting this week.
Yeah, and at that meeting, Sound Transit announced a few things. Most importantly, that it was not interested in doing any kind of even feasibility study, which people tried to get in the city council budget last year, on what it would cost to transition to free public transit, which a number of smaller cities, none the size of Seattle, but smaller cities have moved to this, not only because it's a humane thing to do, but also it costs a lot less than the fare enforcement. At this point, given ORCA cards and all the rest of it, not many people pay cash for Sound Transit tickets. And, you know, the money that they spend on fare enforcement officers patrolling light rail, for example, is almost not as much, but certainly it's expensive enough that it's worth looking at that option and whether it would be cost effective. Some of the other side effects, of course, is that it speeds up the buses because you don't have to worry about fare collection.
Well, it has less impact on people of color because, as it turns out, people of color are disproportionately high among the folks who are targeted by fare enforcement officers.
Yeah, and that same meeting, Sound Transit was very defensive in saying, well, the way we organize the fare enforcement officers, it's totally random. It has nothing to do with
the way they has
nothing to do with profiling
fares.
People.
But I think it was Jesse Hagopian who pointed out that on the first day of school this year, there were fare enforcement officers out in force and ticketed a number of students, and most of them were students of color. And this was the first day of school when a lot of students were trying to get to school in order to get access. They had to get to school to get their free
ORCA cards,
and they didn't have those yet. And how unfair this was, and pointing out that why did they target these youth of color? Primarily because, of course, those are the kids who tend to be lower income and didn't have the money.
Because they knew that they wouldn't have their ORCA cards yet, probably.
Yeah.
And it was a chance for the city to collect fines, which a lot of those people can't afford.
And, you know, it's built into the Sound Transit business model. And that's what the Sound Transit board said this week.
Yes.
That fare collection, fare enforcement, and the fact that Sound Transit has a higher collection of fares than Metro Transit and other transit agencies is directly built into their finance model.
And, you know, to be fair, I think Sound Transit isn't going to be looking at doing anything along those lines until it's clearer what the fate of I-976 is, which would blow a huge hole in Sound Transit's budget.
Yeah, that's the Tim Iman car tab tax initiative that is supposed to lower car tabs down to $30, a straight $30 statewide, regardless of what any local municipality or county has or other agency has passed in terms of a tax on car tabs.
Yeah, and you know, I can see where the support for that comes from. I was talking to a friend this week who has like a 25-year-old beater, right?
Mm-hmm.
And her car tabs are due, and it's $160.
Yeah,
because 130 of that is all local taxes.
Yeah.
So I see where the impetus for that comes from. On the other hand, that money goes to funding public transit, funding improvements to roads, and trying to attack the backlog of maintenance of roads and bridges, et cetera, et cetera.
Primarily because we're one of the few states in the United States that doesn't have a state income tax.
Yes, which brings us to the state legislature.
Yes. But before we get to the state legislature.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Big praise this week for Microsoft announcing that it's throwing more of its money into
the... They're such a responsible, caring corporation.
Yeah. On Wednesday, Microsoft announced that they are adding $250 million to fund affordable housing to the $500 million that they had previously announced last year. But remember, most of that $500 million was a big revolving loan fund.
And remind me once again what Microsoft's annual profits are.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't have that down. But as everyone knows, it is massive. Now, and they have a massive amount of cash on their balance sheet, just kind of sitting in savings. Now, Microsoft said that they had found a way. And now, Microsoft really has found a way for their big surplus of cash sitting in savings to earn some interest as well as good public, good publicity. Now, they're adding $250 million in loans. This time is a line of credit for the Washington State Housing Finance Commission, which makes money available to developers who build affordable housing projects. Usually, the Housing Finance Commission issues tax-exempt bonds to raise money. They can now also pull from their new Microsoft-branded line of credit at an interest rate of 1.7%, which is equal to the highest bank savings account interest rate that's available this week on bankrate.com. So essentially what Microsoft. So clearly what Microsoft is doing is they're saying, instead of us having to move our cash around from bank to bank to find the highest interest rate, we're just going to use that highest interest rate as in our revolving loan funds. So we make money on our cash.
I would lay money, not as much as Microsoft has, but a little bit, that they found a way to structure it it reduces the corporate tax load too.
I'm sure they're
jealous of Amazon.
Yeah, they're also getting some tax preferences or tax credits for supporting affordable housing. Now, notably,
quote unquote,
of the $500 million that Microsoft made available last year, only $25 million of that was for homelessness services, and the bulk of that was for the new regional homelessness agency, the King County Seattle Homelessness Agency. Half or $250 million of that $500 million was earmarked for, get this, market rate loans for housing, for market rate housing, while $225 million, less than half of the total, was for below market rate loans for housing to be built specifically, affordable housing to be built specifically on the east side near Microsoft's campus. Now, when I say affordable, that's workforce housing, which is typically priced for people who make between 80 to about 110% of median income.
Right.
But this week, Microsoft admitted that they're having trouble finding affordable land to buy for building affordable housing on the east side, which is no surprise. So, of course, they're also looking at ways to get King County to loosen zoning laws. My guess is to buy up agricultural land.
Yeah, and wetlands and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Now, Microsoft and local developers say that they're hoping other Seattle area corporations will make similar donations of money for affordable housing. They called it donation, even though it's actually loans. But so far, no other corporations have stepped forward to do the same. Also this week, Microsoft made a promise to be, quote unquote, carbon negative by the year 2030. They announced on Thursday that the company will commit to being carbon negative, to remove more carbon from the environment that their own operations and supply chain produce every year by 2030. So it's worth asking, how are they planning to do that? Well, here is how. Microsoft President Brad Smith said that the company is undertaking a, quote unquote, carbon moonshot. Okay, what does that mean? That means they're...
I'm getting more and more nervous about this.
Yes. They're investing $1 billion over the next 4 years to attempt to develop technology that will scrub carbon out of the atmosphere. Okay. Now, you have to understand that people have been looking at this issue, very smart researchers and scientists.
And a lot of different governments as well.
And technicians have been looking at this issue since the 1990s, at least 20 years, and no one has come up with a feasible... easy to finance solution yet. So in 4 years,
okay,
I really don't think so. This
is an investment by Microsoft, because if they can find that technology and get a monopoly on it, it's like,
oh yeah, you know, it'll be
printing money for the future.
Oh yeah, it'll be printing money for
and
them.
They wouldn't publicly announce that unless they already had some serious leads.
Well, yeah, there are all kinds of great ideas out there. The question is it technologically feasible, and can we afford to do it? How much is it going to cost, you know, and how do you finance it, et cetera? So
a lot of the energy companies are also investing in trying to find that kind of technology so they can transition to it.
They have a real economic incentive to do it, and they haven't been able to do it. So in the meantime, though, Microsoft continues to purchase carbon credits to offset its own emissions. And that, I should point out, is a troubling tactic. It allows them to continue to emit carbon, even though they're financing other things that are less carbon in doing that. Carbon credits are controversial. And they are advocating for the federal government to institute a carbon cap and trade program. And again, I've argued that it's getting really late in the game for market solutions like that. It's really important now that we have to cut our emissions steeply, that we look at regulations and hard caps and hard cuts.
And the federal government's going to do nothing along those lines pending the results of this fall's elections.
Yeah. And then environmentalists have pointed out, too, that Microsoft is continuing to provide software and cloud computing services to the oil and gas industry and other carbon-intensive industries. So even if they change their suppliers' habits and their own habits, they're really not doing much to change their customers' habits. And remember, their customers are their business, and that's the source of their profits.
Their customers are the 7.5 billion people in the world, basically.
Essentially, yeah. But also businesses,
yes.
like ExxonMobil
and big businesses.
BP and so forth.
The U.S. Navy.
So
companies
so,
that build oil and gas pipelines.
This is why when you see announcements like this from, you know, publicly responsible corporations, it's really important to look at the details.
Yes, it is.
But it sure made you feel warm and fuzzy for a little while.
for just a second.
That's the extra carbon in the atmosphere.
All right, moving on. The Washington State Legislature.
Yeah, it's first a new week. Legislative session. This was the first week. There were some new bills out there and some new priorities for the new session. Governor Jay Inslee kicked off the legislative session with his State of the State speech, outlining his top priorities, including pulling funds from the state's rainy day fund to pay for more homelessness services and drug treatment, getting the legislature to pass a clean fuel standard, and expanding early childhood learning and special education programs. He didn't, however, address I-976 and the big $500 million hole in the state's transportation budget, and he made no mention of tax reform, nor did he mention that pulling money from the rainy day fund would require a 60% majority vote by the state legislature. So that's probably not going to happen. Some of the new bills that are already up for discussion that may happen this year, though, include Senate Bill 6128, which would allow cities and counties to raise their local sales tax rates by 0.1% to pay for homelessness services with just a vote by a city or county council and not require a vote by residents, so not approval by voters. Its companion bill in the House is House Bill 1590. Another bill up for consideration is House Bill 2453, which would require all landlords in the state to provide a reason before they evict a tenant. This is called a just cause bill versus no cause evictions, which are legal in most areas of the state, except for Seattle and a couple of other municipalities, which have passed their own just cause ordinances.
Is I didn't like them one of the reasons you can use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just need to give 20. Well, you don't need to give a cause currently. For example, in other parts of King County, a landlord can just give you 20 days, say, and say, you know, I want you out.
Yep.
Here's your 20-day notice.
Yeah.
Not provide a reason.
The state's laws are very heavily weighted in favor of landlords compared to most states.
So this bill would create a just cause reason and increase the amount of time that a landlord would give a tenant to move out.
Does it list what qualifies as a just cause?
No. Well, it probably does, but you know, it's just introduced, so it's going to go through
right.
some amendments, and we'll keep track of that as it goes. It's right just got a hearing. Just got added into committee this week. So we'll see.
And we should mention that as these committees start considering these bills and voting them through, a lot of different nonprofits have lobby days in Olympia. And it's really actually very valuable to go down there and talk to legislators one-on-one.
You can also do the bill lookup, too, if you want to actually read the bill and see what's in it. And you can look up which representatives in the House and senators in the state legislature have sponsored the bill and are shepherding it through. You can also look up the committee that it's in.
The status of the bill.
The status of the bill.
The state actually
and who
does
sits on that committee.
The state actually does a very good job of putting all that information online.
It's all online. So if a bill sounds good to you, write down the number of it. I just mentioned Senate Bill 6128. That's the local sales tax rates, and House Bill 2453, the just cause bill.
But I do want to emphasize what Jav had just said about that there are different organizations that get involved during different parts of the legislative session and go down to Olympia. And a lot of times those organizations will offer free rides for people that are interested to go down with them.
Yeah, you can do carpooling.
Yeah, and The times that I have done it, I found it really valuable.
Mm-hmm. And it is really valuable for state legislators to hear from people in their districts or people in the state about why these bills are so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and because, it can change
because
people's
there's
minds.
There's a ton of different bills that get introduced in the legislative session because there's not enough time. Most of those bills don't make it. And Olympia is a bubble. It's really valuable for legislators to hear from their constituents.
Mm-hmm.
They
yes,
want to hear from you.
They do. They want to know what people care about. Mm-hmm. And it really gives them the ability then to prioritize what they work on in a short 60-day session where there's not enough time to look at everything.
Yes. And you know, for example, the Realtors Association and all the other various industry trade groups, they have lobbyists down there.
Yeah.
So it's important to counter that as well.
They don't need to drive down there. They're already there.
Yes, and let me tell you the value of speaking to somebody who's an ordinary person versus somebody in a suit.
Yeah.
You know, the long line of suits outside your office door is not necessarily going to catch your attention quite like the ordinary mom or pop or kid who comes in and says, hey, you know, this has been my experience, and I think we need a bill that addresses this.
Yeah, so I would really encourage people to go down to Olympia at some point in the next month or two.
Yeah. So another bill that is being introduced is House Bill 2275. That would crack down on cities that illegally spew sewage into Puget Sound by fining them up to 13 cents per gallon of wastewater spilled. That's one of a number of environmental bills that is on the docket this year. Last year, House Bill 1110 passed the House but died in the Senate. It's being revived again this year, just as Governor Inslee requested. That's the bill that would establish a low-carbon fuel standard in Washington state, a very important bill for addressing our climate change emissions.
Now, since the feds have already overridden that in California, would that be an issue in Washington state as well?
I think that's going through the courts right now.
Okay.
Now, it would be similar to standards as Job mentioned, in California, but also in Oregon and British Columbia. This bill would require companies that produce transportation fuels to reduce the greenhouse gases emitted by their fuels over time to reach a 20% reduction by the year 2035. That's in 15 years. There are three options for doing this. One, they can improve the efficiency and leaks at oil and gas refineries. Two, they
can... And pipelines.
Yes. Two, they can blend fossil fuels with cleaner biofuels. Or three, they can buy carbon credits from a producer of clean fuels to subsidize the clean fuel, essentially subsidize the clean fuel industry. That's House Bill 1110. Now, the Republicans are screaming that this bill will drive up the price of gas. But Oregon has seen less than a 1 cent per gallon increase in the price of gas related to their clean fuel law. In California, it's raised the price of gas by 19 cents per gallon. And that's much, much less than California's state excise tax on gas, which is currently 47.3 cents per gallon.
And more importantly, in the long term, it's way less than the cost of spewing more carbon into the
air. Yeah, it's way less than the enormous infrastructure costs and insurance costs and human cost that will come from a changing climate and climate disasters.
And one would hope a lot of businesses are seeing this in their long-term financial interest as well. And that kind of lobbying sometimes
is helpful
carries more
too.
Weight.
Yeah. Sure. So if you're a small business owner or even if you're the employee of a large business that has the ability to push your company to lobby the or works on lobbying the state legislature.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're in a union.
Yeah, if you're in a union, it's also important that you turn out in support of House Bill 1110. Now, House Bill 2311 would increase the state's commitment to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. In 2008, the state legislature passed a bill that committed Washington State to reduce its emissions to 1990 levels by the year 2020. Well, we haven't met that goal. We're now 8% higher than 1990 levels, although if we hadn't made an effort, we would probably be higher than that.
Yeah, and that's been with a lot of population growth in Puget Sound.
Yeah. Now, House Bill 2311 would amend that 2008 bill to set that 2008 law to set new goals of reducing state emissions to 45% below 1990 levels by 2030, 70% below 1990 levels by the year 2040, and 95% 5% below 1990 levels by 2050. In 2050, the state would be required to achieve net zero emissions using carbon offsets and buying carbon credits if necessary.
And that's probably not good enough given how quickly climate change is accelerating, but it would certainly be a huge step in the right direction.
Yeah, and I should point out that without major changes in our transportation policies, that we would not be able to achieve those goals. So again, we're going to have to be looking at cleaning up the transportation sector.
That would require the legislature being able to pass a transportation budget.
Well, a new transportation bill, a balanced transportation budget, and that includes a whole lot more money for transit than for roads, and electrification of the transportation industry, incentives for that. And I'm not seeing that yet, but we could be seeing that.
We could be pushing it this year.
And we could all be pushing for it. That's for sure. The Clean Fuel Standards is just one bill that could help with that. But we need to go much further than that in the transportation sector if we're going to meet these targets.
And much faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was House Bill 2311 to increase our targets. And that's a good bill. Perhaps not fast enough, but it's something. And it's a good start.
Yep.
All right. Is that it for
That's Olympia? It for the legislature this okay. week. I'll be looking at it again next
and
week.
And we should probably mention before we get into the morass of national politics that you're listening to KODX Seattle FM. And we are a volunteer-driven station. We are all volunteer. We depend on listener donations to keep ourselves going. And you can help. There's a Patreon button on the KODXSeattle.org website. There's also a one-time payment option. And
a PayPal
really,
button.
Yes,
you scroll
we
down.
Really, really appreciate our listeners being able to help finance this station.
And if you want to send us a check, you can write a check made out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail it to...
Heads up, Mike.
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. That info's also on the website.
So that's Mike's time to shine each week.
Yeah.
He's better with numbers than we are.
Moving on to national and starting with impeachment.
Yeah, the impeachment trial in the Senate formally began this week with House managers being named and walking the articles of impeachment over to the Senate. It's not clear yet what the rules will be, but it is going to start next week, so we'll see what happens. Meantime, largely damning evidence keeps coming out that strengthens the House manager's case if they're allowed to present it to the Senate. Most notably this week, Lev Parnas, who is a quote-unquote associate of Rudy Giuliani's, who along with Igor Furman and a couple other people were indicted a couple months ago on illegal campaign donations. Basically, they were bundling money from Eastern European and Russian sources and funneling it to Republican candidates, allegedly. So he's awaiting trial on that, and he got all of his electronic devices back from the feds this week, and so he started making the rounds, and he started has provided that information to the House Intelligence Committee and various other investigators, and they started releasing it this week, including another trench last night that, again, clearly names Donald Trump as being at the center of this conspiracy. But it also names a number, and he named in interviews this week, both on MSNBC and with the New York Times, he specifically named a number of other high-ranking administration officials who he said were in the loop, basically. They were all in it.
And Devin Nunes is assistant
I'll get to that, yes. He had a number of questionable contacts with Devin Nunes' chief legislative aide. Nunes, of course, is the Republican ranking member in the Intelligence Committee who has been trying to derail investigations into Donald Trump for the last 3 years. Turns out he's been working hand-in-hand with this Ukrainian conspiracy as well. Also, Bill Barr has been in the middle of it, the Justice Department.
The Attorney General.
The Attorney General. Vice President Mike Pence, who stands to become president in the unlikely event Trump is convicted.
As we've suspected for a while.
Yes, and a lot of the names that you would expect. Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who abruptly resigned pretty much as soon as the whistleblower complaint became public, and you knew he was more involved in this than we had heard to date. And the thing is that Parnas can say this in interviews, and yeah, he's trying to impress the feds with his cooperation and all that, and he's kind of one of these well-spoken, mobby kind of guys that Donald Trump seems to like to surround himself with, even though he has no real relevant experience other than that he's originally from Ukraine and speaks Ukrainian.
Has some government contacts.
Yes, and some of those he got from Giuliani. Mm-hmm. As an introduction. And he introduced himself by, I'm here on behalf of the president's personal lawyer. I'm speaking for the president. So this is a guy conducting American foreign policy, which ought to be terrifying to anybody. But the thing is, for all the explosive claims that he made in his interviews, a lot of the emails and texts that have been released by the House Intelligence Committee this week back him up on that, that he's telling the truth on those things. And again, this will be really valuable evidence for the Senate to see, and they can see it in mainstream news media reports on this stuff, but whether it will be presented on the Senate floor is still an open question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we had a couple other developments this week also. The Government Accountability Office released a finding that the withholding of Ukrainian military aid, forget what the purpose was for, that it was for Donald Trump's personal political fortune, but the actual withholding of the aid was illegal.
Yeah, they issued a report this week that said the Trump administration violated the Impoundment Control Act, a federal law that governs how federal funds are allocated and spent when they held back the military aid to the Ukraine that Congress had allocated.
And we've already seen a lot of documents and testimony, particularly in the House hearings, that was the case, and that a lot of people, not just in the State Department, but also in the Pentagon, were worried that this was illegal and didn't want any part of the scheme. And so it took a little while to implement because the Trump people first had to replace those folks with their own political appointees in order to smooth the process along.
Yeah. What I want to point out from the Government Accountability Office is a quote from their report. It said, quote, faithful execution of the law does not permit the president to substitute his own policy priorities for those that Congress has enacted into law. OMB, or the Office of Management and Budget, withheld funds for a policy reason which is not permitted under the Impoundment Control Act, end quote. And so what they're referring to there is the U.S. Constitution, which says about the president, quote, he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, end quote. And the president's oath of office, where he swears to, quote, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
I don't think that's been a priority.
Yeah, they're putting in perspective here exactly what the crimes of the Trump administration are and Donald Trump's illegal actions.
And
really,
one of the talking points for Republicans trying to defend Trump over the past month or two has been, well, it's kind of unseemly. It makes us uncomfortable. But there were no crimes committed.
Yeah.
That's not true.
It's the prerogative of the president to decide these things. And it's not true.
Yes. Although that has been the Trump administration position for several months now, is that we can do whatever we want. We don't have to answer subpoenas from Congress.
Oh, no.
We don't have to turn over documents. We don't have to do anything we don't want to. And so we're moving to an impeachment trial in the Senate with a lot of key witnesses and a huge amount of key documents that would probably even further underscore the crimes committed by the Trump administration. Those are being withheld from the judicial process. And that's why one of the articles of impeachment is abuse of power.
Yeah.
So you can have a trial because there's already a ton of evidence, but the really key witnesses are important to get out in the Senate. And that's that requires four Republicans to deviate from the Mitch McConnell line. We want to sweep this all under the rug and pretend it didn't happen. You can change the rules of the Senate trial with a majority vote. And the Democrats are claiming they now have four Republican votes to be able to override what Mitch McConnell wants to do. We'll see if that happens, and we're going to find it out this week.
Yeah.
It's
So fasten your seatbelts.
Yeah. One other thing in terms of this whole scandalous mess is that we had a security firm reporting this week that the Ukrainian natural gas company Burisma was hacked, apparently by Russian state actors, using a lot of the same techniques and signatures that were used in the 2016 election hacking. And it's not clear. They certainly got into Burisma's files. It's not clear if they took anything out or if they put anything in, because Rudy Giuliani has been all about trying to find documentation to support his conspiracy theories, which basically were originated by Russian intelligence. So if Burisma suddenly coughs up some documents that are incredibly damning of the Bidens, for example, be very, very skeptical of the source.
Didn't they find that the hackers were using search terms that made it look as if they were searching for the same things that Giuliani and his crew were searching for in terms of the Bidens?
That's correct.
Yeah. So that really points to the fact that the Trump administration, maybe we can't find links to them coordinating with the Russians, but they certainly have been coordinating with the Russians.
Pretty much everything illegal that Trump does, with the possible exception of putting kids in cages, goes back to what Vladimir Putin wants. Yeah. And
all the circumstantial evidence is there.
Yeah, and it's been very consistent over the last 3 years. Everything he does in foreign policy, basically, benefits the Russians. And the $100 million question is why?
Yeah.
Is he acting as a Russian asset? Does Vladimir Putin have some incriminating tapes of him with a nice Russian 13-year-old? I mean, what's going on here?
Or do they just hold a lot of his debt?
Yeah. Well, that's true, too. That's certainly what has kept the Trump organization afloat for the last decade.
Dangling massive profits from new business in Moscow and other Russian cities in front of him when he leaves office.
Yes. And then the idea being that he would be what the Trump organization has been for some time, a money laundering conduit for illegal Russian money.
Yeah.
But in terms of what you were just saying with the two, both Giuliani and this security firm using the same search terms, you know, right there, that's a primo ad for using DuckDuckGo. You know? It'd be really smart to use that. So
The campaign ads write themselves.
Yeah.
They do. All right.
Starting with Moscow, Mitch.
Puerto Rico.
Yeah. The Trump administration is holding up relief funds that Congress approved for Puerto Rico in order to impose requirements, or you could argue it's a quid pro quo before.
That sounds just like Jenny Durkin.
Yeah. Before Puerto Rico will be allowed to have the money that it needs to rebuild. Now, Puerto Rico was devastated by Hurricane Maria about 2 years ago. And this month it's been hit with a series of earthquakes that have been doubly damaging. The island's electrical grid was wiped out in Hurricane Maria and has not recovered since. And many communities are still waiting for any relief funds. Losses were initially estimated at nearly $92 billion from Hurricane Maria. Congress approved $42 billion in relief funds, and the Trump administration has sat on the bulk of it. In comparison, the federal government spent $160 billion on relief after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, and the federal government spent about $125 billion after Hurricane Harvey hit Texas and Louisiana in August 2017.
Neither of those were adequate.
Yeah, just a month before Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. But for Puerto Rico, it's been less than half the need. Now, so what is the excuse given by Trump administration officials for sitting on the money?
It's a really big ocean.
Yeah, well, they want Puerto Rico's government to agree to the following conditions. One, to give all control of the funds to the fiscal board, which is overseeing Puerto Rico's debt crisis, even though it's a fiscal board and not a relief agency. Two, to pay contractors working on relief projects less than $15 per hour, and that's in direct violation of a recent executive order mandating $15 per hour for these types of contracts. Three, or did you want to say something, Job?
The conditions on contractors reminds me that one of the first contractors that was hired for Puerto Rico was a good friend of then Department of Interior Secretary Ryan Zimke. So who these contracts go to is subject to a lot of corruption as well.
Yeah. And not necessarily on the side of Puerto Rico, but on the side of the federal government and Trump officials, mm-hmm. I should point out.
And their friends.
Now, the third condition is that Puerto Rico must create a new system for registering property ownership and deeds, a system that could disenfranchise a lot of poorer residents who don't have a lot of documentation for their home or land purchases. And, I see Mike's wincing over there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a real problem.
It's a land grab.
It is a land grab.
It is a land grab, and it's also a good way of minimizing the vote in this fall's election from Puerto Rico, which I suspect is going to run heavily against Trump.
Yeah. Now, the fourth and final condition is that Puerto Rico needs to agree to not spend any of the relief money on fixing the electrical grid. And that is an insane condition.
Why?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
The answer to that is because the Trump administration believes that there's already been some corruption in the reconstruction of the electrical grid, which I have to argue is no excuse for
it's
not
no excuse.
Fixing
and they,
it.
And they would know about the corruption in the contracts for the electrical
because
grid.
Because they were a big part of it.
Were a big part of it and responsible for it. Yes, I do agree. I think the underlying reason these conditions have been imposed on Puerto Rico and not on the states of Texas and Louisiana, for example, when they received money from Hurricane Harvey relief, is that these conditions on Puerto Rico are really reflective of the deep racism within the Trump administration and the Republican Party.
Not only that, but they are still stung by particularly the San Juan mayor, but a number of other Puerto Rican officials criticizing the Trump administration response. And Trump never, ever forgets a slight.
Yeah. And whereas Texas and Louisiana are Republican and particularly New Orleans are Republican strongholds, Puerto Rico is not.
No. New Orleans is definitely not a Republican stronghold.
Not a Republican
but
stronghold.
But the rest of Louisiana
But the
is.
Area around New Orleans, the rural communities that were also hit hard by Hurricane Katrina definitely are.
Yes.
And I really want to emphasize how much damage and continuing damage that Puerto Rico is taking from those earthquakes. We've aired multiple shows on that this week. From like Flashpoints did great coverage with people who live there.
And already in precarious situation because they haven't had any relief from the damage done by Hurricane Maria.
Yeah, and they're
and now their
far
homes
more
have
damaging
completely
than
fallen
are being reported.
Down. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's terrible.
All right.
Yeah, the need is urgent, and the Trump administration is criminally negligent in not releasing money for rebuilding in Puerto Rico.
All right. On to the Democratic debate that happened this week.
Yeah, there was a debate. It was on Thursday night, I want to say, or Tuesday.
It was
Tuesday.
It was a Tuesday.
Night.
That's right. The days all blur.
And
it didn't get as much attention because, of course, impeachment was in process at the same time. But there were six Democrats on the stage this time, most notable among the ones not on the stage, Andrew Yang, who's been on there in past stages. Of course, Cory Booker had dropped out. Tom Steyer was on the stage, which really speaks to one's ability to buy the way into a Democratic primary. A lot of the media focus has been on a supposed rift between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, which I don't believe the reports.
I'm rolling my eyes.
Yeah.
As if there aren't more important issues to discuss.
Mm. Well, it's a way of discrediting the progressives and lifting up the moderates in the race as being, you know, the more responsible adults, quote unquote. I thought Warren was particularly good in the debate, actually. And Sanders was himself, which is always good. They certainly haven't hurt their cause. And Sanders is now leading in the polls in Iowa, which is only 2 weeks away.
Yeah, and I think a lot of us who are on the left have been wondering when, you know, because Sanders and Warren have been pretty amicable so far, and they haven't really targeted each other in the debates and in the campaigning yet. We've kind of been wondering when that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised that it's starting up now just before the Iowa caucus when Sanders is really ahead and Warren has been falling back in the polls.
She's been flagging. She wanted to make a splash. She did now, do that.
I'm not saying that that's the main reason why she's saying this. You know, it's very possible Bernie might have made an offhand comment that she took the wrong way. We know how that goes.
Yeah.
Us women in particular, we yeah. know how that goes and how easy it is for men to do that. I'm not saying that, there isn't a little bit of residual sexism or just plain sexism on the progressive left. And racism on the progressive left.
Absolutely.
The difference, though...
The white progressive
left. The difference, though, is when we point it out, it shouldn't be something that divides us. It should be something that allows us to unite and grow and change.
And
I think there's more possibility of that on the progressive left than there is on the main sort of mainstream white liberal spectrum.
Yeah, so I would
Biden
take,
and
I would
Buttigieg,
take all,
for example.
I would take all the media coverage of the supposed rift between Warren and Sanders with a huge grain of salt.
Yeah, well, or just say, you know, why are we tearing each other down because of it? Let's talk about ways to heal because of it.
Yeah, and you know, with the Women's March this week and the MLK March this weekend as well, it's a good time to be talking about oppressions of mm-hmm. women, of people of color. Of all people who are disadvantaged in our society. And that's something I would trust any of those people on stage on Tuesday to do better than the current occupant of the White House.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we only have a couple minutes left, so...
Oh, my.
I am...
Time flies.
It does.
I know it's hard to believe. So I'm not sure what we if we just jump to international. How about the trade deal with China?
Yeah, that was announced by the Trump administration this week. It's really not a trade deal as so much as the framework for a trade deal. None of the sanctions that Trump has imposed are going to be lifted. They won't be increased, which is good, but it's already hurting large sectors of the American economy, particularly manufacturing and agriculture, because, of course, China has introduced reciprocal trade. That's what trade wars are about. And this really won't stop that. The framework does have some positive things around intellectual property, assuming that they're actually, you know, enforced, and some other things that Americans have been complaining about but China's trade policies for years.
It doesn't go nearly far enough in addressing the issues that Trump identified as being big problems with, and that big businesses have identified as being big problems with U.S. trade with China.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other piece is that any of these trade deals at this point have to include climate change-related benchmarks. And that's not something the Trump administration is interested in.
No.
It is not part of the secret sauce. All right. Events.
Yeah. As I mentioned, there was no Women's March this week. That has been postponed till March 8th. So mark your calendars now. However, Monday is MLK Day. And the annual MLK workshops and rally in March. The workshops will start at 9:30 at Garfield High School, 23rd and Jefferson. And then there's a rally at 11 o'clock, and at noon, the march sets off.
So I have some events, too. I have an event listed for Wednesday, January 22nd, a panel on Indigenous reparation and recognition.
I had that one as well, yes.
In Seattle, that's hosted by Marcus Green, the founder of the South Seattle Emerald newspaper. The panel will discuss how Native Americans are pushing for greater representation in our fast gentrifying city. Panel members include Fern Renville, Russell Brooks, Rachel Heaton, and Maggie Mertens, and there may be more folks. That's
and
from.
I'm not familiar with the others, but Fern is great.
Yeah, that's from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at Town Hall.
Yes,
at 7th and Seneca. Also on Wednesday at Town Hall is the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. There's an anniversary lecture with Erica Hart, who is a podcaster. She approaches sex education, health, and wellness from a queer, anti-racist perspective.
Yeah, and she's African-American.
Yeah, that's from 7 to 9 p.m., also at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca.
And also at Town Hall, the following night on Thursday, January 23rd at 7:30, Who Can We Trust? Technology's Impact on Democracy, which sounds dry, but it's actually a really, really important topic right now.
And it looks like a good program.
Yeah, it's a great panel they got lined up. That'll be $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca, downtown Seattle.
What time is that?
7:30.
Now, next Saturday, January 25th, is the Tax Amazon Action Conference. That's a coalition of groups who will be discussing different options for an Amazon tax or a corporate version of a wealth tax in Seattle and what that money should be used for. That's from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Washington Hall at 153 14th Avenue, about a block north of Yesler Way in the Central District.
And one of the organizers of that is Councilmember Sawant, who is actively looking at trying to introduce legislation along that line.
There's also some other union groups that and environmental groups that are also part of that coalition.
So the question will be, what comes before City Council? What do they consider?
Yeah.
And that's your chance to have an
input. Or another option is, rather than trying to take it through City Council, doing a voter initiative.
Yep.
For that, I think that's one of the options they're considering. So if you want to get in on that and learn what's going on and give your input, that's next Saturday, January 25th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Washington Hall.
Yeah, of course, you'll have to catch our program afterwards, but that's okay. It's a good cause.
Yeah. Take your radio or your phone with you and stream our show.
Or through the chip implanted in
your brain.
Yeah.
That's
one of our fundraising techniques.
I bet that's something Google's investing in right now is research into
them
that.
And Microsoft.
Yep. Right. Yeah, it's a question of who's going to get the monopoly.
Who's going to get there first?
I hope it's not Apple, because it won't be compatible with anything.
So we'll plan on seeing you both next week.
We will be here.
We will be here.
Yeah.